Hello and welcome to the Relationship Matters podcast. During this time of upheaval and social conflict going on in the US, CRR Global and the Relationship Matters podcast supports the stand against systemic racism, racial bias, and the history of Black community oppression. Relationship matters regardless of race and ethnicity. We believe relationship matters. We believe Black lives matter. We believe all voices matter. In this episode, Marita Fridtjon is calling for productive dialogue around race and racism. What are the blind spots that stop us from connecting deeply in these kinds of conversations? What questions aren't we asking? And how might we be missing what is really being said? Here's Marita to explain more. Well, it's lovely to have you back on the podcast, Marita. You mentioned that you'd like to talk about dialogue today, dialogue specifically with questions.
Well, yes, it feels like you and I, when we came on the call this morning, had to do that, because just for our listeners, came on, I could hear Katie, she couldn't hear me. Signed off several times, she checked on her side, I checked on my side, she couldn't hear me. So at some stage, went off, checked everything again, came back on, and nothing has changed, but now we could hear one another. So to me, it feels so much as if that's part of what we're busy with. And for me, that is the question. What are the signals around us, even the smaller ones, that points us to the place where I think you hear me, but the sound is off? Or we think we are live, but the screen freezes. I think those are the things that, if we could walk through the day with, where is the screen frozen today? I see a picture, but it's not the real picture. It's the frozen screen. Where is it that I am speaking and I get upset because I don't feel heard, but they actually don't hear me? It's just those two things that happened for us today feels like it's such a parallel process with being in dialogue and struggling with one another, technology and whatever else, without having the answers to the question that we're asking.
Yeah, those blind spots that kind of makes me think that it's not about the right question, it's about what questions aren't we even thinking about asking. You know, that's the blind spot that maybe we haven't even noticed yet that's there.
I think you're right. And I think that the problem, the challenge with blind spots is that I can't see them. Somebody else has to tell me about it. You have to tell me that you can't hear me. And then we have to go to a different channel. So for me, I think we so often talk about that we as white people need to be able and really be able to talk about our white privilege. And that's absolutely true. But I keep on speaking, unless I get feedback, I keep on speaking from my blind spots. I keep on thinking that I'm heard speaking about that. But what if I speak from a blind spot? What if I speak from the place of my privilege, like people go, I heard that so many times, just shut up. It's like, it's the blind spots. What are my blind spots? And only the person outside of me can tell me what that blind spot is. So I think one of the conversations that would be great for us as privileged whites is to actually ask the question, where are my blind spots? And for us to be in dialogue with people that we disagree with and have that conversation. What's the blind spot that I see in you? Because that's very different from, here's what I think, here's what you think, and here's what you, and because that ramps up and it doesn't get us anywhere. So where are my blind spots? That's another question to walk with.
And will we always have some kind of blind spot? Can we ever be free of these blind spots?
I think it's inevitable that we have blind spots, because even if somebody tells me about it, when I, as privileged white women now living in the US, are talking about Black Lives Matters in this situation, I'm heavily influenced by my experience when I was in South Africa and on the Faculty of Social Work, and would walk into our course room in Cape Town University, one of only two universities that were open to everybody, walk into our course room, and the room was half empty because the half of the students that were not there probably were detained somewhere else because they didn't have a drive, because of whatever, they didn't have a pass, they didn't have a... So for me, when I look at Black Lives Matter in the U.S., I am really looking from a heavily influenced viewpoint of a past experience. Does that mean that I totally understand what's happening here? Probably not. Because even in that, I am looking with some kind of personal bias. So what is the conversation that I need to have? Or what is it and where is it that I need to be informed by people about those blind spots? Because what's happening here is not, in essence, it is the same. And there's also a different something to it. And that's the complexity of it.
Yeah.
Challenges that we are in at the moment, because it's very real in the US for us. And we have to work with it. We have to talk about it. But what it's like in the UK, and you can speak because you know from that situation, lives matter. And diversity matters, and it's a very different conversation from the one that we're having here at the moment in the US. So how do we stay? Does that become a blind spot for me sometimes? Yes, because I'm so focused on what's happening here now that I actually develop a blind spot for what my colleagues and other coaches and other faculty and people experience in London on the street, or in Paris, or in China. We don't speak enough of the complexity. This is what it's like here. What's it like there? I knew I was going to come into this conversation with you without having answers. And I think that's okay, because I don't even know that there are the right questions, which is part of what we talked about before.
Yeah. And there are so many levels to this that it would be an injustice to try and pretend that we can solve it here in this conversation.
I'm just curious, since I talked about the UK just now, what are some of the diversity, racial issues there that manifest in similar ways, but also are different? It's not just Black Lives Matter. It's, you know, other ethnicity and racial divisions as well.
Yeah, I was thinking about this because it is a different issue. Yes. In the UK. I'd say Islamophobia is a really big problem, particularly after the London bombings.
Yes.
There's a similar thing with regards to sort of segregated communities and different opportunities. So it's as you say, it's the essence of the problem, but it's not quite the same. We have to, I think, tackle each one slightly differently because they're all going to need a different kind of, not remedy, but repatterning, restoring, to take this into a different future.
Yeah, that repatterning that you're talking about, or restoring, I think that I don't know that any of that can be done until there has been enough expression or ventilation, as we call it in our alignment work. But until all of that has been heard, I don't know that much can change. And because it's so multi-generational, the needing, wanting, having to listen to that, view and observe it is part of our practice, because it's taken millenniums to create this. It's not going to go away with one protest. So what's the self-care and the self-awareness that we have to sit in?
Because there are levels to the privilege I've started to notice as well. Being yes. British in America, there's a lot of privilege there.
Yes.
And I only realized recently, actually, that, you know, I'm called supposedly an expat, whereas other people's are called immigrants. And I don't entirely yes. understand why there's a distinction there. Really, I'm an immigrant as well. But I get this status yes. because I'm British.
Yes, yes, yes. And again, I don't know, because you and I have had many conversations, I don't know whether I spoke about this before, but those levels of privilege, because as faculty in Cape Town, although we were on the streets on the side of colored and Black people, we were still white. I too in custody, but I could be bailed out more easily than my students of color. So even there, I'm proud that we could stand But I can't be too proud because I still stood from privilege. Part of what we need to remember here as well.
What can you do then?
Own it.
Own it.
Own it. Even as white activists stand next to Black and people of color, and coming from South Africa, I have to be able to distinguish because Black is not the same as colored, and there's no derogative term in there. It really is different cultures. But even if we as whites stand there, even if you and I have this conversation, we're still two white women having the conversation. And we have to have it. Those are the pieces that's, I think, part of our job in this, or part of our responsibility in that job, is for us to be able to talk about it. But to talk about it in such a way that we don't go into competitive despair with people that really have a very different experience of this and are the people of color that are being discriminated against in a very violent way. So I think we have to continue to talk. And we have to be prepared to be found wrong. And we need to be prepared to find out where the blind spots are. And I think one of the things that I'm working with at the moment, and, you know, talking in our office team, and we'll talk together with faculty as well, I already have, is I wonder what it would be like if we, as white privileged organizations that 90% of the time don't have enough diversity, I wonder what happens if we walk with the question, who's not here? Really, if we in the U.S. think about our students in our coach training courses and really ask the question, who's not here and how can they be invited and honored here? That might change a lot. And even there, I had a conversation yesterday with somebody that, because we were having this conversation, and there was a conversation about scholarships, and we caught one another because there was the assumption that people are not there because they don't have the money. Because they're Black or they're whatever. That's true in certain situations. But there also are highly educated, wealthy Black people who can afford to do our training, but who are not there. Why? What is it that we do and represent that doesn't make it inviting? I think that is a question that we are sitting with in the coaching industry and as leaders.
Does that also stem to then certain industries which are biased towards one gender, or, you know, there's lots of company cultures where, you know, there's not enough Black people, there's not enough women.
That's where the complexity comes in.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's like discrimination and societal breach of contract is, we can make a bumper sticker of it. It is. And you can fill in the blanks of what it is and fill pages or a fair amount of computer data. But that, I think, is the thing that gets me interested. I think that's the thing that I really am working with at the moment. What if the place that we're sitting at the moment is we know we don't have enough ethnic diversity in coach training. But what does that even mean? How can you feel in order to address that? I do think there's responsibility for outreach that asks the question why. But we first have to identify who is not here. Is it blind people? Is it Black people? Is it fat people? Is it, what is it? And then I had a dream last night. It was very confusing. But dream was that we were somewhere on an island. God, I can't believe it. There was this massive conference. And I can't tell you how many times I woke up from the dream because I was confused. Because I was walking around and there were like thousands of people. But then I started getting that they were all different. There were people in wheelchairs. There were people of different colors. There were clearly old-fashioned hippie-type whites. There were, it's like, and then there was the awareness that I really am in a world conference of diversity. What do we need to do? I think that's the work that Ani Mandel is trying to do. What do we need to do to bring together that? All the people that's not here now, who are they? What are the opportunities that we can create for all of them to speak together and for more outreach and more humility for us to begin to go there and ask what needs to happen?
And thinking about it on an individual level, because it feels so big, when you say it like that, you know, this island of...
Yeah. Well, that, can you imagine that I was confused and didn't have a good night's rest?
Yeah, and then it suddenly feels so big, and the thing I don't want to do is, because it's so big, step away, turn away. That's what people have been doing for too long. So what's the thing that I can do as an individual right now, looking around, thinking, yeah, there's a lot of people who aren't here?
That's great, because I do think that that's where there is, I as an individual have different privilege or lack of privilege than me as a CEO or as name whatever. So I do think that question is a really useful question for me personally. When I look around in my neighborhood or in my circle of influence, who's not here is a very different question from thinking about students and faculty and asking that question, which is a very different question from sitting with my own inside team, if you will, and have that conversation. Who's not here? Who's not in this conversation today? The one that I'm ashamed of. The person who, when I walk to my car in a dark parking lot and somebody with a hoodie on walks my way in the darkness, my assumption will be that it's a black person that means harm. I'm ashamed of that. But it is part of my inheritance, and I have to work that all the time. So on a personal level, I actually think that's the white fragility conversation we need to have. That really is about who are all of myselves. I know the ones who had to have the politically and ethically and whatever correct conversation. It's part of what sits in this call. Who are the others that are mine that's not present in the call that I need to make relationship with and do something with? So I think it's very much on the me that is about emotional intelligence. And I think it's very much on the we that is about who's surrounding us, then who's absent. And how do I invite, bring, humbly ask, whatever it is, I don't know, but bring them in. What do you make up about that?
I think it makes me think that I'm only listening from one level, one angle, one perspective. And whilst we might be hearing in the sort of literal sense, are we really listening?
Yes, yes. That's actually part of what I'm going to walk away with, and I'm going to ask you to do it, and I'm going to ask our listeners. Really think about, if I look around me, and I'm going to make it looking from the inside out, because that's where it happened. You froze on my screen. If I look around me, as I step into a grocery store and there is somebody behind me in the line or in front of me or the cashier, what is the frozen frame of my perception of that person?
Ooh.
When I sit with my partner in a certain environment, what is my frozen frame of that person across from me? Because only when I recognize the frozen frame can we do something with it. Now, in smart psychology language, we'll talk about a projective process or whatever. I want to get down dirty into business. All of us walk around with frozen frames of black people, of Asian people, of white people, of Republicans, of, it's all frozen frames.
Yeah.
Own them. And then what do you do?
Yeah. What are we not seeing because we're focusing on past events or things we are born into, these biases? And actually, can we start seeing the potential in this person, the future, as opposed to looking back?
So for me, two takeaways. Continue with the question, whatever place I am in, you're in, we are in. That's the question. Who's not here? Who's not represented? How do we reach? And play that game of frozen frame. When I look at somebody, what's the frozen frame? And that mostly for me, I think, is, it wasn't the case with you because it was tech, but I may be most aware of the frozen frame when I feel irritated with somebody. If I'm irritated with somebody, I'm probably in a frozen frame of that person, with that person.
That's fantastic. I'm going to try that, Marita. I'm sure I have many uncomfortable frames, frozen frames that I probably won't want to admit.
Yes, I know I have. Being human is being part of that. But I think that's, when we talk about dialogues that we talked about in the beginning, I think those are the dialogues that are the vulnerable ones, that are the courageous ones. And I think from that, remember the physics law of non-locality. When we have this conversation, when you do it in one place and build different frames, the somewhere else, it's already different as well. Law of non-locality. If it changes here, it will change somewhere else as well. And that, I think, sometimes is the most provocative and useful changes that we can make, is when we believe that and hold that.
Thank you, Marita.
Thank you, Katie, as always.
Thanks, as always, for tuning in and staying with us in that uncomfortable space. My two key takeaways from this episode are as follows. Look around and ask who's not here. Stay open, curious, and investigate the networks in your life. Become aware of your freeze frames. Notice your automatic response, get discerning about what triggered it, and encourage yourself to stay in that uncomfortable space. Because some of the greatest opportunities to learn and grow exist outside of the comfort zone. In the show notes, you can find links to organizations in the US to learn from, get active with, and help each other. This includes Black Lives Matter, Equal Justice Initiative, and American Civil Liberties Union. From the boardroom to the living room, we believe relationship matters.